702.
The Aubrey Masango Show.
Live, online.
Smartphones, DSTV.
92.7.
And 106 FM.
Grave Murder is the name of the book, the story behind brutal Welkom killing. And the author of the book is my guest, Jana van der Merwe, in our Crime Time feature. Jana, thank you so much for joining me this evening. I really appreciate your time.
Oh, thank you, Aubrey, for inviting me.
So, in that sleepy little town of Welkom in 2011, it was a little, it's a small little mining town, as I understand it. Never been to Welkom, by the way. I need to need to change that. But the most heinous things were taking place, Jana, and you decided to write about them. Why?
Yeah, so Aubrey, I must say, before that, I wasn't so familiar with Welkom either. Like a lot of murders, people don't know about Stella and Griekwestad and these smaller places. But Welkom is indeed a city. It is a, I would say, a large town.
Yes.
But yeah, something very shocking happened. You know, in April this year, it would be 10 years ago that the murder of Michael van Eyck happened.
Yes.
You know, when he was killed in the graveyard in Welkom.
He was discovered, of course, in a buried in a shallow grave on the outskirts of the local cemetery. Tell me about what started the ball rolling for you, just in terms of your own curiosity that led to a full-on investigation and ultimately the book that you've written.
Mm. You know what, Aubrey, at the time of the murder, I was working for Volksblad newspaper in Bloemfontein. You know, Volksblad is not, and Bloemfontein is not very far from Welkom.
Yeah.
You know, and when we heard about this murder, you know, it was just so shocking. And, you know, it was actually, you know, quite close by that it had happened.
Yeah.
And, yeah, when he was found, you know, it was a very macabre, that's the right English word, it was a very absurd scene. You know, he was found in a shallow grave without his head, without an arm, and with one of his feet missing. You know, that started the ball rolling at the time. You know, what was behind this murder? Was it like a Mutti murder? Was it something to do with Satanism? You know, with the body parts removed.
Yeah.
And, you know, later when it was discovered, you know, who were the two people responsible for the murder, you know, and what had actually happened in the days after the murder, you know, that is what really was the shocking, haunting part of this story.
Look, I don't want you to give away too much because I'd like for folks to buy the book, hey, Jana. But who was responsible for the murder and what did you discover?
Well, in a nutshell, it was a young woman by the name of Shanay van Heerden. She was an art student in Welkom at the time at a local college. And her boyfriend, Martin van der Merwe. You know, and it just, I think just on face value, I don't know, that it's not that I think one can spot killers in our society.
Mm.
But, you know, they just looked, you know, just like ordinary citizens. Yet, behind the scenes, it was a very, very dark cult that the couple had formed.
When you say cult, you seem to be suggesting religious undertones to the activities that they were involved in that perhaps motivated the murder?
Yeah, so this was what made this murder so shocking and almost renowned today is the fact that it's only one of 10 reported murders in international history where a corpse was mutilated for psychological purposes.
Sure. So I'm reading here that she, what was her name, the young woman?
Shanay
was a petite, innocent-looking young woman with fantasies of skinning and flaying human skin. And he, what was his name?
Martin.
He was diagnosed as schizophrenic who fantasizes about committing cold-blooded murder. How was all of this found out about their inner workings, these fantasies that they had? How was this discovered?
basically, you know, this murder, it was believed by the forensic psychologist at the time, you know, if these two people had never met, this murder would probably have never have taken place. Like you say, Martin, since he was a child, he had a fantasy in his head of stabbing somebody, of killing somebody. You know, but it wasn't necessarily something that he would have done. Shanae, on the other hand, since she was a small child, she had fantasies of skinny. She actually started on small animals when she was very young. Sure. And when these two people met, these two very sick individuals, you know, very much introverts, they didn't have a lot of friends. When they actually met, ironically, at a mutual friend's house, you know, they started chatting to each other and actually discovered that they had these fantasies. And it actually worked out. You know, the forensic psychologist actually said in court it was a match made in hell. Because, you know, the fact that he wanted to stab somebody, she wanted to skin somebody, you know, and she needed a corpse for that. And now he had a reason to give her one. You know, and that's how the murder happened. Yes, and I think it unfolded. The fantasies that they had unfolded when Michael's body was discovered that day.
Why was Michael singled out for this crime, Jana?
You know what, Aubrey? Wrong place, wrong time, I would say. They were actually looking for victims quite a few months. When they had discovered their mutual fantasies and started discussing it, they actually even roamed the streets looking for victims. You know, but I mean, it's not as easy, I think, to find a victim. And she ended up going, I don't know how they came about the idea that she went onto an internet chat site. That day, you know, like we had Mixit back in the day.
Yes, I remember Mixit, yeah.
And Michael just happened to be on the site. And I think, you know, he was quite an unlucky victim that he was the chosen one, but I think he also fell victim because he was a very naive young man.
Yeah. the investigator who said that this was a match made in hell couldn't have said it better. I mean, because I can imagine that to be able to divulge that kind of information to each other, there would have needed to be a very strong intimacy between the two of them. There would have needed to be a very strong bond between the two of them. Was that is that what you've discovered in your investigations?
Definitely. I think when they met each other, they were like magnets to each other. One forensic psychologist, Dr. Duplow, Professor Duplow, said it was like an explosion in those words when they met. And I think they started talking about the most normal, mundane things, just being how are they introverted and alone and don't have a lot of friends, to actually really trusting each other in a very short space of time to divulge to each other these very sick fantasies. Yes.
It was a big story at the time. I mean, I remotely remember hearing about this story, but it was obviously a very big story. It would have been a big story in Welkom, but it was a story that resonated quite strongly throughout the country. And by the way, give us a call as I speak to Jana van der Merwe. She's senior reporter at Die Huisgenoot and You magazine, talking about the book that she's written, Grave Murder, the story behind the brutal Welkom killing. If you remember that story and you remember the time and the general atmosphere in the country around that particular story, what do you remember of the conversations that would have been taking place at the time, Jana? What were people saying? What were people thinking prior to the discovery as to who had dismembered young Michael?
Sure, you know, interestingly, Welkom had quite a reputation in that time for Satanism. There was a lot of, I just remember that time, there was a lot of things revolving it, but the occult, you know, in these, not that, like I said, it's not a town, it's actually a city, but you know, in these smaller places, the young people don't have a lot to do and they think up all this stuff. So, Definitely people thought, you know, there was some kind of satanistic motivation behind it. And, you know, later when the murder was, you know, when the motivations and everything was discovered and people were saying, oh, no, but Satanism and what was it, it was actually Shanae's father that said, you know, it's like people, to make sense of something like this, it's they want to compartmentalize it, they want to put it in a box.
Yes.
And remove it from their own reality. You know, coming from her father, it was quite profound.
What did her father say? What did her father say?
You know, when he was extremely shocked when he heard that his daughter had been involved or was being accused of being involved. And when he heard the talks, when people said Satanism and the occult, you know, he didn't know his daughter as being involved in that kind of stuff. And he said, well, it's easier for people to try to make sense of it by putting something in a box.
Yeah, I think usually as individuals, as communities, whenever we don't understand something, the easy thing to do is to label something and put it in a box, and that way we can manage it, right? At least we think we can manage it. But was that the prognosis? Was that what people discovered, that indeed satanistic involvement, or this was some sort of a satanistic ritual? Was that the final understanding in this particular case?
No, not at all. They did, you know, the experts that testified, you know, did say that it had some kind of, you know, cult vibe to it, you know, almost like the devil's door killers, Kruger's door killers, you know, that kind of, some kind of cult, some kind of their own little rituals, you know, and these two, they didn't belong to any formal satanistic church or anything official or formal. They actually just dabbled and experimented and made up their own little ritual. So at the end of the day, it was discovered that, you know, it actually really had nothing to do with
I find that very consistent with many of the murders that people have attributed to Satanism or some sort of occult religious ritual. That most of the time these are people with just very deviant desires and fantasies. But it's perhaps society, we who talk about these things, that then assign a particular reason that we are comfortable with. It makes us comfortable because we then feel, okay, we can control this particular situation. But that begins to make us ask even deeper questions, Jana. And I'm not wanting to ask you these questions because I think you're a psychologist. But just from your investigations and looking at this kind of thing, what was the fundamental motivation? I mean, I know that they had these fantasies to skin people and to kill people. Mm-hmm. These two young, seemingly innocent individuals, right? Mm-hmm. Do we know, perhaps from psychologists that were involved, forensic investigators, criminologists, do we know what was the reason why they became like that, to the point where they were able to stalk and find an individual and then behead him and skin him?
You know, it's interesting, Aubrey. You know, I covered this case, back in 2011, and fast forward to 2016 to the Krugersdorp killings. You know, I also covered that quite deeply. When you start asking, you know, why, what motivates people? And I think for that resonated with me with both of those cases, and also that came out in court back in the day with the grave murder, is that when these people come together, you know, these deviant personalities, these sick fantasies, it's almost, if you have to summarize, it's almost like they find a very deep sense of belonging. If you understand what I'm saying.
I hear you. I get that. Yeah, I hear
that.
Yeah.
What Shanae and Martin found in each other, apart from how for me and you how crazy it sounds and absurd it is. They found a very deep sense of belonging. And it's the same if you look now at the Krugersdorp case, it's more recent. It's these group of very odd individuals coming together and finding a common purpose, a belonging. That's what I would say. And I think it's also what the experts said that time.
Tell me about, you know, one of the things that I try to do when listening to stories of murderers of this nature is I try to sort of step back and not be judgmental, right? Which is very difficult to do under these circumstances. But I think I get what you're saying, that that when people feel so deeply alienated from society, when they feel like they are so completely they are nonconformist, they just are deeply, deeply alone and lonely, perhaps.
Yes.
The kinds of things that they then get involved in that bring them together in the way that Shanae and what's his name?
Martin.
Became close, right? Is indicative of how deeply alienated they were. So as deeply alienated they may have been from society and society's norms and therefore the moralities of society, that you will not kill somebody, you will not behead somebody, you will not flay somebody in the way that they did, you then get a sense how deeply alienated they were in to society by the crime that they commit. And so I want to ask this question. The father, of course, in trying to protect his daughter, I would imagine that those parental instincts kick in, saying the things that he said about, you know, you don't know until you do, kind of thing, you know? Did he perhaps have comments as to why his child was so deeply alienated from society's norms, from society, to be able to cut somebody's head off means that you're deeply, deeply alienated from the idea of morality, of the basic ideas of decency. And did his father have any idea as to what that may have been the reason, what the reason may have been for his daughter to be that way?
You know, listening to what you're saying, you know, honestly, I read in the book as well, some people might find it extremely boring, but other people that are really interested in how the mind works would find it extremely interesting was the messages between Martens and Shanae. The type of messages, they called each other Dexter and My Lady and all kinds of funny names, and they almost like created a little world for themselves. But when she also switches to conversations with her father on the same day. And then she'd just be perfectly normal. Hi, Papa, I'll see you tonight for the bride. You know? So he didn't really know. I don't believe he really knew what was going on in his daughter's mind and behind closed doors. But you know what? She was one of those very angst kind of teenagers. She was very depressed. She cut herself severely. And I'm sure He must have seen what she was doing to herself. And it never came out that he actually ever got professional help for her, because I think she had been crying for help for a very long time about what was going on in her head.
We've had conversations about killers in the same vein on this very same this very same slot. And sometimes we get to a point where we say, oh, this person was, I believe that they were called shared psychotic disorder. But I'd like your comment on this, that sometimes we pathologize, as I suppose we should. It's a pathology. It's some sort of sickness. But do we not, in the moment of trying to diagnose, again, this need for us to control the narrative by giving it a name, right? Mm. Because it makes us feel a little more safer. Do we not perhaps fall into the trap, Yana, of not giving the full responsibility to the perpetrators of these murders by doing precisely that, by saying, oh, this person was sick. Maybe this is their normal. This is who they are. This is what they are. They are not sick. This is who they are.
Mm. Oh, yeah, but you're saying, I mean, in the court case, it came out with Shanae. Oh, she's a psychopath, you know, labeling. She's a psychopath. That's why she didn't feel anything. And Martin's was, well, he's a schizophrenic, you know, but... Yes, I mean, it comes down to how much of it is just them, like, in their fiber, in their genes, who they are. I hear what you're saying. It's almost like you're mitigating it.
Yes.
You're saying, oh, well, he's that. He's schizophrenic.
It's almost an arrogance almost of society that wants to give the impression that it is impossible to be that way unless you are sick. And I'm beginning to wonder, as I have different conversations about identity, about sexuality, about the labels we choose for ourselves, the pronouns we choose, I'm beginning to get the sense that humanity is far more complex than what we are comfortable with, right? That we tend to want to be labeling people and then pathologize them and say, oh, no, he's sick, so that we can feel like we are in control, when maybe he's not sick. In fact, he is in his element when he's ripping people's heads off. That's who and what he is. That's the creature that this person is. Was that kind of conversation ever had when you were investigating? And I know that, I mean, we want to be able to catch these people and put them in jail so that we can feel better about ourselves. But was there ever that kind of conversation that said, wait a second, maybe we are looking at all of these things wrong?
I must say the prosecutor in the case, Advocate Joanne Denison, you know, he had zero sympathy for these two. Like, he highlighted, you know, when Martins went to, because, you know, they took some of the body parts to the flat. They took his
head. Oh, my word. You really?
Where Shanae skinned with surgical precision, skinned his face off. And when Denison touched on that, when Martins pointing out to the police where they had buried the body parts, he was standing there smiling. And he went on for quite a while in court. Why are you in this photo smirking? Why are you laughing? Why are you so impressed with yourself? You know, now he's looking all, you know, sorry and I'm schizophrenic and I didn't know what I was doing. But you see, there you look very impressed with yourself. So I must say, in court, he was very harsh on them. You know, Shanae said outright, you know, I don't feel anything, and if I had a chance, I would do it again. You know, and I think even though these labels, one doesn't want to, in court, it's quite important because, I mean, it's one thing to put somebody in jail, but we all know that at some point that person needs to come out of jail. And when they come out of jail, what threat are they going to pose to society? You know, that's when it becomes important to discuss what's going on in their head and who they are and how to label it.
My guest is Yana van der Merwe. She is a senior reporter at Die Huisgenoot and the U magazine. We're talking about her new book, Grave Murder. Yeah. Grave Murder is the chilling account of how appearances can be very deceptive, how those who might seem innocent and harmless on the outside may hide some dark, disturbing secrets that are just waiting to be revealed. Please give me a call if you know about this story. If you were interested in following the story back in 2011, I'd love to hear your thoughts. What was the feeling in the country at the time? Perhaps you're listening to us from Welkom. Give us a call. What was going on in Welkom at the time? What were the conversations that were being had? I'd love to take those calls on 011-883-0702 or 021-446-0567. Jana Fanameva is my guest. Jana, let's talk a little bit about the victim, Michael van Eck. Who was he? And how did his star collide with these two individuals?
So, you know, Michael van Eck, he was around, I think, 23 years old at the time.
Oh, my.
You know, I don't know how old you are, Aubrey, but for me, you know, he was
I'm twice his age.
23. you know, he had barely finished his studies as a, his training to become an electrician. You know, his parents were extremely proud of him, that he had completed this this training and that he was going to work at the local mine. And, you know, when the murder happened, he had just received literally his first salary that month. Yes, Michael, you know, Michael was a very family-orientated young man. He had a bunch of sisters, three older sisters, one younger. You know, he didn't have blue eyes, but he was his mother's white boy, as they call it. They did everything together, you know, almost like, I know some people will probably think, you know, why am I saying this? But, you know, almost unhealthily, you know, they did everything. She did more things with her son than she actually did with her husband. You know, if she went shopping, it was her son. When she went to the doctor, her son would take her. I think also because her husband worked very long hours.
Yeah.
So she was exceptionally close to him.
Was he the only son?
He was the only son.
I see.
Yes. That's why
at some level, it makes sense.
Yeah. And he was, I think he actually grew up in a very protective environment, you know, shielded environment in his family unit. So I think he was very naive when a girl suggested to meet him in the graveyard.
Is that what happened? Is that what Shanae did?
Yes.
Was that the scheme? Was that to say, listen, let's meet somewhere?
So she said, to him that, you know, they're on a dating site, you know, let's meet at some place secluded, and you can just ponder why he would do it. You know, Welkom, like you said, is also small. You know, everybody recognizes everybody if you go out to a bar. And, you know, Michael wasn't really a party type of guy. He wasn't somebody to go to clubs or bars. And so, yeah, that's why he said he'll meet her at the graveyard. And obviously she had other plans for him.
Did they know each other prior to the meeting on the dating site?
No, they were complete strangers to each other.
You make a very interesting comment, Jana, about the relationship between Michael and his mom. And then I asked the question, was he the only son? I want to excavate that a little bit more. You warn us that you even say that relationship was a little bit unhealthy. The closeness between Michael and his mom was a little bit unhealthy. Are you suggesting incestuous issues?
No, not at all. I think about my brothers, for example. I have two brothers, and you know, my brothers were a lot more, for my mom, a lot more independent. You know, they'll go play their sports and do their own thing, and, you know, where they were almost like best friends.
Right.
You know, if you understand what I'm saying, it's not often, you know, you get sons that are very close to their mom, but it's not often that you get a relationship where you go shopping together and you do everything together and you laugh and cook and do everything like constantly in each other's space. And I think that's why her son's murder really hit Henriette van Eck.
Oh, my.
She was, in the years that I had to do with her, she was completely and utterly crushed, even to this day. It's completely destroyed her.
Is Shanae and Martin still incarcerated?
Yes, they are. So they were arrested quite soon after the murder and confessed to it. So Martin's got a lifelong sentence. In 2011, that same year. Shanae got Oh, I'm got a bit confused. Shanae pleaded guilty first, and she was incarcerated first, but she didn't get a lifelong sentence. She was given a 20-year sentence back in 2011, and she was actually declared a dangerous criminal, which meant that it's quite unusual. It doesn't happen often in our legal system that somebody's declared a dangerous criminal, but what it means is after 20 years in prison, she needs to come before a panel, and then she needs to be re-evaluated because the expert at the time said that she was a serial killer in the making, that it was not possible for her to be rehabilitated. So she's obviously still in prison. She got 20 years. Martin, the year after, because he's a diagnosed schizophrenic, he had to go through quite a number of psychiatric evaluations to declare whether he was fit to stand trial. And in the end, in 2012, he got lifelong imprisonment. So, yes, they are still both very much in jail.
Give me a call on 011-883-0702 or 021-446-0567 as I speak to Yana van der Merwe, senior reporter at Hayes Convert and You magazine, the author of the book Grave Murder, the story behind the brutal Welkom killing. Give me a call and let me know if you believe that people that are capable of doing something like that are, shall we say, rehabilitatable. Is the correctional service that we have in our country equipped to deal with that level of deviance? Give me a call. And our approach to, as society, approach to crimes of this nature, yeah, are we diagnosing these kinds of crimes correctly? If the correctional service is about rehabilitation, that it's not about the punitive, measures of society, but it is about trying to rehabilitate an individual of that nature, somebody who fantasizes about flailing somebody's skin, somebody's skinning somebody, beheading somebody. Is it possible to rehabilitate somebody like this? Were these some of the questions that you dealt with, Yana? Questions around the
Certainly.
The levels. Of the is our justice system, maybe not justice system, but our correctional system, does it still believe that somebody like this is rehabilitatable?
You know, Aubrey, there were a lot of questions around this, things that come up to me. When you think about a motive, often we see, it's external motivations. In our country, murder is very rife. People get killed, sadly, on a daily basis. And it's often because of the criminals got some kind of external motivation, that they want to rob them. They want to hijack them, steal from them, some kind of incentive like this.
Yeah.
Where this was not, the incentive was not to rob.
Yeah, it wasn't a crime of survival. It wasn't somebody who's hungry.
It wasn't at all.
This is not even a crime of passion. It's a crime of pleasure, almost.
Yes, that's the way the whole thing about the serial killer thing comes along, because they're psychologically motivated. The incentive is some kind of rush, some kind of pleasure to derive from it. I think in this case, the team, the prosecuting team, I forget Joanda Nason, you could not have asked for a better prosecutor, because he really delved into the psychology of these two people and declared her a dangerous criminal. And I believe definitely if you get serial rapists, for example, or child molesters, and these, often some of them should be declared a dangerous criminal, because how many times have we seen people come out on parole and they rape again? They commit these crimes again. I don't think, personally, I think there are a lot more people that should be declared dangerous criminal.
Have investigations checked whether or not these were in fact, these two young people were in fact serial killers? I know that we only know of the murder of Michael van Eyck, but has there been perhaps subsequent investigations that may suggest that both these killers had killed before? Is there any suggestion of that nature?
Well, the suggestion was that they were serial killers in the making. So they started off, and I mean that, we recently had this whole case about the Mannenberg cat killer. You know, these cats disappearing and being slaughtered. You know, they were doing this a long time before Martens and Chennai. They were abducting cats. I don't know where they got these pet stores, wherever at the time then. SPCA even, they got cats. They would slaughter them. She would practice on them. He would stab them to death. She would skin them. You know, so already there for the psychologists or the experts in this case, I could see there was like a thing forming in the background.
So they need they needed to kill. It wasn't just a matter of learning how to remove the skin from the body, but it was also part of the process of learning the feeling of taking a life and being comfortable with
their
that.
Fantasies.
Yeah.
And so in court, when Shanae right out said, you know, I would do it again because, you know, they actually kept the serial killers and you know, these profilers like Dr. Gerard Labuschagne from the, you know, previously from the police's forensic, head of the forensic unit. So, you know, there was a lot of signs that they would do it again because they thought they were going to get this rush and they didn't quite get it. So, you know, they would need to do it again. To get it. They also kept, paraphernalia, things or trophies, things of that that's stolen from although that was not the motivation.
Yes.
Things that they had, like trophies, like they kept his CDs and his purse and his glasses and his eyes in a little bottle and his ears.
No.
And, you know, what serial killers do. I mean, we see this in movies. We see it on Crime Channel. But they really did do that. So they were serial killers in the making. He actually suggested that they would do it again to get that rush again.
What has this done for you, Jana? I mean, going into this kind of investigation, I doubt you come out the same person. you know, I mean, the detail that you would have seen, the gruesome detail that you would have seen, trying to understand the mindset of these two murderers. What did it do for you?
Oh, what an impact it had on me. You know, for me, you know, it started, it's a funny thing. You know, you as a journalist, you think, oh, this is such an interesting case and it's so unique. And, you know, you think you're going to write the book and you're going to put it down and it's done.
And you'll keep that distance, but it sucks you in, hey?
It sucks you in. I mean, for a time when I was writing it, because now I'm interviewing everybody that was involved on the scene that spoke with them. You know, it's almost like it literally feels as if you are getting into their minds. You have to think like they think, and it's a very dark place. You know, I was as a journalist. More from an outside in, whereas the people that were directly involved, you know, one of the investigators in the case, she was out of the police for 2.5 years due to post-traumatic stress disorder. She could no longer work with any crime scenes.
And you?
Even the investigating officer, she actually... When she was the investigating officer, and she later moved to a whole different unit with vehicle theft. You know, so, I mean, the people that were very directly involved, I mean, the PTSD, post-traumatic stress, was real because you can't actually think that
even possible. So on Twitter, at Mulan says, it's really puzzling how cold-blooded murderers are always excused for being insane. Sometimes humans are the ones that makes this seem acceptable by trying to find suitable language for this brutality. I'm not sure if you get what I mean. I absolutely get what you mean, Mulan. Absolutely get what you mean. And that's the question that I was asking Yana to say, you know, do we not at some level excuse this behavior by suggesting that somebody who behaves in that way, who is involved in this kinds of crime, is somehow insane? Because these people were not insane. They were very calculated. They were very calm. They were very clear in what they wanted to achieve. Maybe insanity is a bigger, broader label. But I don't get the sense that these were people that had no control over their faculties and were therefore dysfunctional. They were very, very functional. They were very, very controlled. The only issue here is that what they did was just unacceptable. But I don't think that they were insane, Yana. Would that be fair to say?
No, definitely. No, they were not insane at all. I mean, like we discussed, I mean, what they were doing, I mean, in itself, what they were doing to these animals, this animal abuse, brutal, severe animal abuse for a long period of time. They planned this murder for long, looking for victims. She lured Michael on a chat group. She spent at least a day or two convincing him to meet with her.
Yeah.
So definitely not insane.
Listen to this. This person says to me, Aubrey, no normal human being can kill another human being in such a brutal manner. Most of these crimes are carried out by occultists, carrying out delegations from their masters because they join and promised high rewards for whatever well-executed job, even after jail term. If lucky enough to trace back their masters, they get what they were promised. These crimes are not well carried because these people are not deeply questioned about the movie or the motive, because no one can just behead and skin another human being. Even a mentally ill person knows that killing is not good. And that's what I argue against this idea of normal that we impose on all of humanity. I'm suggesting, Yana, that this is their normal. It is obviously abnormal to society, but that's who these people are. That's their normal. And that's why I kept on asking the question, is our justice system, is our correctional system moving towards that kind of interpretation, or are we still perhaps in the interpretation, as my listener suggests, that no, they couldn't have done this unless they were abnormal? And I'm suggesting to you that that's who they are. That's their normal.
Well, Aubrey, listening to what you're saying, I mean, if you just look at the crime statistics in our country, the high level of crime, the murder rate, rape, all the violent crimes that we are seeing, I mean, it's sky high if you compare it to other countries. So definitely there is something wrong. We must have also put up a mirror and look at us as a society.
Yeah.
Are we so violent?
Let me quickly take a call from Anonymous in Johannesburg. Anonymous, hi.
Bro, hi.
I'm very good, thanks. Hi, Anonymous. What is on your mind, sir?
What's on my mind is that I hear what you are saying, guys, and I'm one of the guys who was very bad. I've been in prison, incarcerated, sentenced to 20 years because of the harsh crimes that I've committed and so on. But after a while, after about 10 years and that, I was considered for parole. And I went for parole and I completed, and they decided to release me back into society. Okay?
Yeah.
And I'm not saying I'm proud of what I did at first. It was very horrible. It was very bad.
Yeah.
But my point is, rehabilitation is possible. This rehabilitation that takes place, I think sometimes in life we go through some seasons which I don't know what causes that season and so on. But in that season, we think that is nice. That is what we want to do in that
yes.
season.
Yes.
But we find ourselves, I'm not saying all, but there are people like me who find themselves,
yeah.
who get back and to their senses and say, but what I did was wrong, was horrible. Now, how do I find my way out of the situation? How do I right my wrongs?
Yes.
You know, because one thing that I know is that we all have what you call the conscience or the conscience or that heart to know that, but what we did is wrong. We can try to
justify. But is that true, though, Anonymous? Do we all have it? You see that's the point that I'm basically asking to say. Do we really all have it, or are some of us just born without it?
Probably. I believe we all have it.
Mm.
I've been there. I've been with harsh criminals. I've been one of them. And so
yeah.
when we are in ourselves and that, when we speak man to man, when we talk and
yeah.
we can act wise before other people, but I believe that we all have the conscience.
Anonymous, so I've got to let you go, my brother. We've run out of time, but wow, what an interesting call, Yana. Interesting call there, yeah?
Yes, very interesting. I'm happy for Anonymous. I'm
yeah.
grateful that
yeah.
our system has been positive for him in his life.
Yeah. How do people get the book?
So the book is available on ebook on Amazon and also on takealot.com.
Grave Murder, the story behind the brutal Welkom killing by Yana Fanamava. Thank you very much for joining us, Yana. I really appreciate your time.
Right. Thank you, Aubrey, for having me and the listeners.
Great.